So how did they put the Vogel plan into action? Because Vogel wasn't the first politician to promise to, you know, to build public works on the back of borrowed money. Central government and provincial government debt had grown eightfold in the 1860s. But as I mentioned, only Canterbury and Otago had really been successful in building infrastructure. But the early 1870s was a different time. The wars in the North Island were pretty much over. But also, quite significantly, the British railway network was largely complete. There were English contracting firms who were looking for work overseas. One of the main ones was called John Brogden and Sons. Another factor at this time was a period of rural unrest in parts of Britain, which was displacing farm labourers and encouraging them to look at opportunities elsewhere and to undertake what was still a very long and difficult journey to the opposite end of the world, and pretty much a one-way ticket for most people. So it was a big step to take. What Brogdon's did was bring workers to New Zealand. So in 1872-73, they recruit 1,300 working-age men, some of them with their families, mostly agricultural labourers from the south of Britain, south of England. And they contract them, they give them a free passage to New Zealand if they work for 2 years on the railways, building railways. Now, those numbers are pretty small compared to what happened later in the 1870s once the government starts its assisted immigration scheme and tens of thousands of migrants come in. But it was the first step in that immigration, the development of immigration in the 1870s. And it also helps push the central government into offering more generous assistance to migrants. And it opens up a lot of channels where there's sort of chain migration once these first batch of workers come out. They were called Brogdon's Navvies. The name was a British name for especially railway workers, but it originally came from the men who built canals, and they were called navigators. So they start working in the early 1870s on contracts near Auckland, Wellington, Napier, Picton, Oamaru, and Invercargill. That's where they start off from. Of course, there's already some railways in Canterbury and Southland. And how do they do it? Well, there was no machinery. They worked by hand, with picks, shovels. They had horses and carts. They had dynamite, which was a pretty dangerous way of doing things. This is some of the country that they're working in. This photo is actually a bit later. This is in Otago. And this one, again, is from a slightly later period, but the techniques and the tools are very similar. What they're doing here is digging a cutting by pushing earth down into a chute, and it's been carried away by a horse and cart. So they're basically just using gravity to dig through a hillside. But basically muscle power. Machines weren't really used to build railways until after 1900 in New Zealand. Now, inevitably, there were problems with this, with the Vogel plan. It wasn't going to be plain sailing. There were delays, there were disagreements with government officials. There were industrial disputes, in part because New Zealand had a tradition of an eight-hour working day, which was very far from the case in Britain. And these workers were expected to work longer hours, and when they got wind of the local custom, they thought that was a pretty good idea. And by the mid-1870s, the government was offering assisted passages from Britain to anyone without having to work for 2 years. So when a lot of the navvies heard of this, they wandered off and got jobs elsewhere. There were better paying, easier urban jobs and farming jobs. And by the end of 1872, very few of those original ones are actually still working on railways, only about 300 of the 1,300. And so they cancel further migration. But the scheme keeps going because there's a larger pool of workers in New Zealand available. Now, by that stage, at the early 1873, Vogel's got a few worries about the plan himself, partly because there's such a clamour for railways from the public. Members of Parliament always want railways through their electorates. It's going to help them win the next election. There are also local railway leagues pushing for a railway to be built through their town, even if it's not the most sensible way to build a railway. They want it to go through their town or their region. And more money's needed. So one of the things Vogel wants to do is to reserve land alongside railway lines as a crown in the crown to help pay for the scheme. But this gets them into conflict with the provinces, especially Canterbury and Otago, and they defeat that plan in Parliament. And this is a really crucial point in Vogel realising, and other centralists realising, that for the government's development plans to succeed, they really need to to abolish the provinces so that the government is in complete, central government's in complete control. Now, provincial feelings were still very strong in New Zealand, but most politicians, even in the provinces, realised that only central government could do this kind of work and pay for it. And so Parliament agrees to abolish the provinces in October 1875, and that comes into effect the following year. By that stage, Vogel's ministry is no longer in power, but other governments continue the railway building programme. And so along with the building the railways, this abolition of the provinces is another key, really crucial moment in establishing the strong central government that New Zealand's really had ever since. And this is actually still quite different than a lot of countries in the world where they have more federal systems, including Australia. So the Vogel plan initially builds on what's already there, and it makes its quickest progress in the South Island. By 1879, New Zealand's got its first main trunk railway between Christchurch, Dunedin and Invercargill. And the Christchurch-Dunedin section was completed in 1878, and it cuts travel between those cities to under 11 hours, which seems a long time today, but it was actually much quicker than the alternative of going by sea or overland by horse-drawn carriage. This is the locomotive that hauled that first train in 1878. It's in Ashburton today. It spent 50 years dumped in a river as flood protection before people restored it. It's an American locomotive. And New Zealand's early railways, as if you think back to that earlier picture of Canterbury, were very English in style. They were like Thomas the Tank Engine. But from the 1870s, they become more American in style. And this is one of the very first American locomotives in New Zealand. And this is very much the kind of locomotive if you'd see in Wild West movies with the cow catcher. And just a very different than English style locomotives. From the next year, 1879, the railway goes all the way to Invercargill. And that's New Zealand's first main trunk. So in 1880, this is a very high-tech map, but this is the South Island railway system. And you can see it's pretty extensive. The top part between Christchurch and Picton wasn't completed until 1945. And the Transalpine line to Greymouth in 1923. But this was the more easier part of the country to build on, although there's still some pretty major engineering challenges. The North Island, on the other hand, this is 1870. There's not a lot going on. There are no railways, so that's easy. But the Vogel plan starts building the first railways in the North Island. Auckland's first railway is from Britomart, near the site of the current station, to Onehunga on the Manukau Harbour. It's built by Brogdon's. Opens in 1873. More importantly, soon after they start building a line down into the Waikato. And it's following in the footsteps of General Cameron's Imperial troops the decade before in the Waikato War. And it's linking Auckland into that fertile Waikato Basin, and there's 1 million acres of confiscated Māori land there. By 1880, it's reached as far south as Te Ao Mutu, which is the boundary to the Te Rohe Patai, the King Country, as Europeans knew it. The Māori heartland where the Kingitanga tribes had withdrawn after the wars. And that is an area that's still off limits to Pākehā, so that's a major barrier to railway construction from that point. You can see elsewhere in the island there are short lines that have been built. Wellington's built a railway to Masterton over the Rimataka incline, which was a major engineering feat, but not a very efficient railway. And other lines are being built in isolated sections, but there is a plan as early as this stage, to link them up into an island-wide network. And by 1880, New Zealand Railways is operating almost 2,000 kilometres of railways. So in 10 years, New Zealand's gone from being one of the most trainless of Western societies to having one of the highest rail mileages per capita in the world, although it's actually got a very low rail mileage in terms of land area. But as this map particularly shows, the impact was very uneven. The South Island was overwhelmingly the centre of railways at this time. And there's a huge gap there. Māori land, the rugged landscapes of the North Island, mountains and very deep gorges, slowed rail's progress there. And at this stage, 1880, trade between the settlements is still very, very much maritime. But that's slowly going to change. And one of the crucial things the government does, and Vogel is again heavily involved as treasurer, in the Stoutt-Vogel government. In 1885, they negotiate an agreement with Ngāti Maniapoto to start building a railway through the central North Island. And it's slow progress, but over the following years, a network begins to take shape. This is 1890. And by 1900, Wellington is connected to Napier and New Plymouth. And the central section is being built quite slowly by 1905. And then in 1908, it's linked up. And it's also, by that stage, there's lines into Rotorua and further in Northland.